Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Secretary of State John Kerry came to the reopened U.S. Embassy in Cuba Friday to salute the American flag as it was raised again in Havana, ceremonially ending the 54-year breach in relations between the United States and Cuba. Kerry spoke from a courtyard beside the flag, facing the embassy with the Caribbean Sea behind him.
I want to pay tribute to the people of Cuba and to the Cuban-American community in the United States. Jose Marti once said that everything that divides men is a sin against humanity. Clearly, the events of the past, the harsh words, the provocative and retaliatory actions, the human tragedies, all have been a source of deep division. That is why I am heartened by the many on both sides of the straits who, whether because of family ties or a simple desire to replace anger with something more productive, have endorsed this search for a better path.
The embassy reopening will allow more Americans to travel to Cuba and give Cubans increased access to the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe expressed feelings of profound grief and sincere condolences to those who suffered and died from Japan's past military aggression while making his highly anticipated public statement on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Upon the innocent people did our country inflict immeasurable damage and suffering, Abe said, adding that the use of force was misguided, and pledged in the future to always seek peaceful reconciliation. This is the Voice of America. Chinese authorities are continuing an investigation into what caused two gigantic explosions at a warehouse in the main port city of Tianjin, as fears linger over the possible presence of dangerous chemicals near the site. Several small fires were still smoldering early Friday at the site of the blasts, which occurred late Wednesday. Officials say the death toll from the blast has risen to 56, including 21 firefighters. Over 700 people remain hospitalized, 33 reported to be in serious condition. A team of 217 military, nuclear, and biochemical specialists, along with a group from the International Atomic Energy Agency's Beijing office, have been dispatched to the area, this according to the official Xinhua news agency. Reports from Libya's coastal city of Sirte say dozens of people have been killed in fighting there this week between Islamic State jihadists and rival gunmen. The country remains in turmoil 4 years after the overthrow of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The latest clashes erupted when a Salafist Muslim group and armed residents attacked Islamic State fighters in Sirte, accusing them of killing a prominent local preacher. Libya is split between two governments supported by armed troops fighting each other. Eurozone finance ministers are expected to endorse a $93 billion bailout deal for Greece after the Greek parliament approved the package. The bailout package passed the Greek parliament by a comfortable margin. Mr. Tsipras told lawmakers that the bailout package is a necessary choice for the nation despite unwelcome tax hikes and spending cuts. Greece needs the money from international creditors by August 20th when it must repay about $3.5 billion in debt to the European Central Bank. A closed Pakistani military court has sentenced 6 men to death after convicting them for their involvement in the Taliban massacre of 134 children at an army-run school in Peshawar last year. The military said Thursday the 6 civilians confessed to helping the gunmen who attacked the school in December. The massacre of 134 children prompted Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to reinstate the death penalty just 2 days after the attack. Police in Bangladesh's capital have arrested 2 suspects in connection with a brutal killing last Friday of an atheist blogger. Dhaka police say they have arrested Saad al-Nahin and Masood Rana. Both men are suspected members of Ansarullah Bangla Team, one of 2 groups that has claimed responsibility for the slaying of Nilroy Chakrabarty. 40-year-old Chakrabarty was hacked to death last week by a gang of men. He was the 4th secular blogger killed in Bangladesh this year. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Moro says the decision for President Kiir not to attend the talks was reached after a two-day meeting of cabinet ministers and the governors of all 10 states. He says the negotiating team is being recalled so that they can debrief the government and other officials on what has been agreed and disagreed in the last week of talks in Addis Ababa.
That's reporter Philip Tonaliu on news that South Sudan President Salva Kiir will not attend peace talks in the Ethiopian capital. Details next. Also in the news, the French news agency says President Muhammadu Buhari has given the Nigerian military only 3 months to defeat the Islamist radical insurgency of Boko Haram. And a new book describes the African nation of Angola as an economic miracle for its rapid transformation after a brutal civil war. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in for Sunny, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, will not travel to Addis Ababa for peace talks with opposition leader Riek Machar. That was the bombshell that was dropped today in Juba, just 3 days before the warring sides are expected to sign a peace deal. Cabinet Affairs Minister Martini Elias Lomoro told the reporters that government negotiators have also been asked to return to South Sudan for consultations. Philip Tonaliu reports from Juba.
Lomoro says the decision for President Kiir not to attend the talks was reached after a two-day meeting of cabinet ministers and the governors of all 10 states. He says the negotiating team is being recalled so that they can debrief the government and other officials on what has been agreed and disagreed in the last week of talks in Addis Ababa. Lomoro says there is another reason for the decisions which could sound the death knell of this last chan of peace talks.
It was also agreed that we have to establish in clear terms what is happening in the camp of the SPLM-IO, because we heard on the 7th 13 of the generals that are in the ranks of the rebels have defected and declared Dr. Riek Machar as not their leader and that another leader has taken over.
Lomoro says that is the reason that President Salva Kiir will not travel to Addis.
If the president is going to go to Addis Ababa, he must go with a clear mind as to who he's going to meet and negotiate with. So we are requesting IGAD to establish and to inform us that whether Dr. Riek is still in charge and whether he's able to reconcile and agree with his people and reunite, or we should negotiate with both parties to the conflict in the SPLM-IO camp.
Machar SPLM in opposition has played down the announcement earlier this week by two former rebel generals that they have set up their own movement. In an interview with South Sudan in Focus, one of the generals, Gatou Gatkwath, said the main grief of the new movement is with President Kiir and Machar. He said the two leaders are taking part in peace talks in Addis Ababa not for the good of South Sudanese people, but because they went to secure their positions in a future government. Lomoro says the government of South Sudan considers a warning from IGAD Plus lead mediator Siom Mospin that negotiators will not leave Addis unless they sign a peace deal by Monday's deadline unacceptable. Siom told reporters in Addis Ababa yesterday after a meeting with negotiators from both sides.
We have all IGAD countries here, and the message they have been passing across to the chief negotiators is one and the same. You cannot leave Addis Ababa this time without signing this agreement by the 17th of August.
Siom also expressed frustration with the South Sudanese warring sides. He said the international community has lost patience with President Salva Kiir's government and the rebel movement led by Machar. This time, the Ethiopian diplomat said the deadline for the two sides to strike a deal will not be extended.
Enough is enough. It is frustration and hopelessness that is reigning in South Sudan and all over the world. There is no any other chance.
The deadline for a peace deal to be signed is Monday. Lomro says the South Sudanese government expected a different caliber of statement from the negotiating team.
This, we feel, is not the attitude and the language of a mediator, but the language of somebody who has intentions, bad intentions, for the Republic of South Sudan. And we think that the IGAD leadership should really rethink their position in the way that they approach the mediation team.
Lomoro says the South Sudanese people should remain vigilant as the August 17 deadline draws closer. He did not say what steps the government will take once the deadline has passed. Eastern Equatorial State Governor Luis Lobong Lojore says the decision of the government should not be allowed to derail the peace talks.
We want to appeal that the IGAD Plus and others international community that bringing about peace require, it is a process, require time, and it is better to go slowly but sure rather to rush and sign a peace that will always create more problems.
There have been government rallies in recent weeks against the peace agreement that IGAD Plus expects the two sides to sign around 72 hours from now. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The French news agency says President Muhammadu Buhari has given the Nigerian military only 3 months to defeat the Islamist radical insurgency of Boko Haram. Mr. Buhari issued the deadline as he swore in his newly appointed service commanders. The president had vowed to take the rebels head-on when he was elected president in March. The president, who is a former general, fired his predecessor's national security advisor and the chiefs of Nigeria's army, navy, and air force. There has been strong criticism of Nigeria's prolonged effort to combat Boko Haram extremists who have plundered three states in northern Nigeria for the last 6 years. The UN Refugee Agency says the repatriation or deportation of thousands of Nigerian refugees from Cameroon and other neighboring countries has led to a shrinking humanitarian space for civilians escaping the six-year war between Boko Haram insurgents and the Nigerian army. The UN agency says it recognizes that surrounding countries have sheltered Nigerians seeking asylum, but it suggests they move the refugees further from the conflict zone instead of sending them back into danger. The agency says they have reminded West African leaders of the international human right to seek asylum in times of war. Meanwhile, Nigerian police say at least six people were killed on Wednesday in a Boko Haram raid on the village of Bale Maman on the outskirts of Maiduguri in Nigeria's Borno state. A military and a vigilante source said eight people have been killed and four women abducted during fighting that lasted about 3 hours. Across the Nigerian border in the Cameroon village of Achachia, Cameroon, army units claimed they killed 20 Boko Haram fighters who attacked the village. One soldier died. Cameroon has shut down the offices and studios of Pan-African television channel Afrique Media as part of an apparent continuing crackdown on journalists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Peter Isoka, acting president of Cameroon's National Communication Council, NCC, says Afrique Media defied a one-month suspension it was given in June of this year and continued broadcasting. He says two journalists working for the media company also did not respect a six-month suspension they were given for what officials say was repeated professional misconduct.
The divisional officer for Yaoundé 2 and a number of officials of law and order went to that media house and sealed it. But as we hear with the latest information, was that they are still broadcasting, but it's the responsibility of the divisional officer or the administration to follow up on the measures they've taken.
The Communication Council also accused Afrique Media of making unjustifiable accusations likely to impair the image and honor of personalities, institutions, and foreign countries. Kininsom of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists says the channel should have respected the suspension order.
When we talk about the press, we should also talk about ethics. If we pretend that we are free with the violation of ethics that we are seeing, one day get up and discover that the journalism that we're claiming to be protecting is no longer there. How free is the journalist who has just walked into the profession without even trying to see what the ABC of journalism is all about?
Manyi Tada Juliana and Muhammad Bashir Ladan, the two journalists who were suspended and their colleagues have not been seen since the police sealed their office, but the channel, headquartered in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, has continued broadcasting. Last year, Reporters Without Borders said the very high number of summonses and suspensions handed out in Cameroon was an indication the NCC had taken a tough line towards journalists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
According to experts, a plan to reform tax collection in the Democratic Republic of Congo could help plug massive leaks in the system. But the reform is complicated by the recent creation of 21 new provinces, and observers warn that corrupt individuals might yet find ways around the new systems. VOA's Nick Long has more from Kananga in central Congo.
The DRC loses around $15 billion a year in uncollected revenue, according to President Joseph Kabila's anti-corruption advisor. Tax collection is particularly poor at the local government level. In Kasai Central, for example, Provincial Finance Minister William Kazumba says the government is only collecting between 10 and 20% of what's due. A new automated system could help close that gap, he says. In the future, tax collectors will print off receipts for taxpayers from their computers, or if they're working outside of the office, from handheld machines.
Quand il rentre, on peut sortir une bande avec tout ce que lui a perçu comme argent et a donné.
When the agent gets back to the office, says Kazumba, the machine will show what he has collected and the receipts he has given, and that will prevent the agent from handing over less than he has collected because it can be checked. But local politician Jim Mukenge of the opposition UDPS party does not think the system will work.
The agents who are going around trying people to pay their taxes will use the old system. They go to a store, get a cut, and they go put the other money into the system.
And Minister Kazumba agrees that computers or automated devices won't necessarily cut out fraud. We can't leave everything to the machine, he says, because the machine is handled by a man. And if the man is corrupt, he will put in false data. The machine can't contradict him, says Kazumba. It can't say, no, what you're telling me isn't true. In theory, the machine could be a block on fraud if what taxpayers should pay is already on the machine. But whether that can be achieved here is still an issue. VOA asked KS Infosystems, the company implementing tax reform in the province, whether it has received the taxpayers' data.
Still, we are giving to the training to our people. After that, they will enter to the in the system to the correct data.
The company spokesman said no, actually it has not received the data, but it is still training people and afterwards they will enter the current data into the system. One fundamental reason for automating tax collection is to cut out manual operations by human beings, says Julian Adey, lead tax advisor for consulting firm Adam Smith International. He says there are many other problems with these kinds of reforms in developing countries. Probably the greatest, he adds, is lack of confidence about how tax money will actually be spent. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Nineteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new book describes the African nation of Angola as an economic miracle for its rapid transformation after a brutal civil war. But critics of Angola's longtime government say the high-rises and expensive new houses in Angola's capital have come at a high cost. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
In the last decade, Angola has transformed itself from an impoverished, war-torn nation into an economic powerhouse. Its capital, Luanda, is a glittering testament to that. The coastal city is among the most expensive in the world. The nation's oil wealth has brought Lamborghinis to its streets and yachts to its marina. University of Oxford lecturer Ricardo Suarez de Oliveira has written a book on the transformation.
Angola had a civil war that lasted for 41 years and that killed a million people. By the end of it, obviously, Angola was in tatters. What happened over the subsequent decade was absolutely extraordinary. The economy of Angola multiplied tenfold. It was the greatest growth story in the world in the early 21st century.
But Angolan activists say the growth hasn't benefited everyone. Angola is one of the world's most unequal societies. Elias Isak leads the Angola program for the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa. He says the lightning pace of development has left far too many people behind.
It was necessary, but the problem is the way it was done. It came at the cost of a lot of people have been completely marginalized and excluded from this process.
Among the casualties, say activists, have been human rights and free expression. Human Rights Watch has accused police of using excessive force and arbitrary arrests to stop anti-government protests. And journalist Rafael Marquez de Moraes, who was recently convicted of defamation for a book he wrote on abuses in the diamond fields, questions whether Angola has really developed at all.
What development? That's the question we have to ask. When you build high rises in Africa, especially in countries like Angola, where there's so many, people tend to believe that the high rises translate into development, but that's not true. It has the highest child mortality rate in the world, worse than Afghanistan. What development is that we cannot provide the basics to save children?
He says many ordinary Angolans find themselves gazing up from the gutter at the glare of skyscrapers and asking that very same question. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Mauritania's parliament has adopted a groundbreaking law making slavery a crime against humanity. The law passed Wednesday criminalizes 10 definitions of slavery that now include child marriage, forced marriage, and giving widows to others without their consent. Although slavery was abolished 35 years ago, rights groups say it still flourishes in many forms. The resurgence of the abolitionist movement in Mauritania is one of several local rights groups fighting for enactment and enforcement of the new anti-slavery law. Meanwhile, Africa has reached an important milestone this month. There have been no reported cases of polio anywhere in Africa for an entire year due to a huge and prolonged vaccination drive backed by international NGOs, medical professionals, local chiefs and religious leaders, and tens of thousands of grassroots health workers and volunteers. The crippling and sometimes fatal virus once struck 350,000 people a year, many of them children. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Helen Rees of South Africa's University of Witwatersrand about this achievement. She chairs the World Health Organization's International Health Regulations Emergency Committee on Polio and the WHO's Advisory Committee on Vaccines and Immunization in Southern Africa. Dr. Rees began by telling Adam Phillips a bit more about the polio virus itself.
Well, polio is an infectious disease, and it's caused by a virus. It's something that we've known about for many, many, many years, really hundreds of years, but particularly in the last century. Polio is a virus that enters the body, usually through the mouth, into the body through the gut, and it affects and attacks the nerve cells of the body. Many people will be familiar with seeing people with limps or with limbs that have withered and shrunk, permanent damage to the nerves and to the muscles. At its worst, though, polio kills because one of the other areas that it affects is the muscles around the lungs. And so it can actually kill people and frequently did in the days before immunization.
Now, how has this been a problem in Africa?
Many infectious diseases have been a problem in Africa, and immunizations and vaccines have really changed the face of many of those diseases, common diseases that we take for granted that we don't see anymore. But immunization has been profound, and for polio, that's also the case. But before we had access to polio vaccines, There were literally hundreds of thousands of cases of polio every year, mostly affecting young children. The world really took stock when we managed to eradicate smallpox. And we did that through immunization. And the world sat up, the global health world sat up and said, well, if we can do this for smallpox, can we do it for other infectious diseases? So the next one we've tackled is polio. And there's been an enormous effort that's gone on for many years, not only in the African region, but throughout the world, really trying to push immunization really aggressively within communities and with communities to eventually eradicate polio from the world. Nigeria and Somalia were the last two countries in the continent to have cases of polio, and their cases were in July of last year in Nigeria, and in August the 11th, was the last case in Somalia. So we're now a year where the African continent has not had a case of wild polio, and that's profound, and it's been achieved by this enormous effort to immunize repeatedly vulnerable children and children even in the most inaccessible areas.
But I understand there was a signal departure this time because they mobilized a lot of people on the ground in terms of communities, and they were able to speak to the tribal chiefs and other kinds of people in positions of authority to be believed, because there was a lot of challenges in terms of the suspicion around these things, etc. So what was different about this time?
Yes, the country that we'd never managed to stop polio circulating within the country was Nigeria, and particularly northern Nigeria, which everyone knows is also very affected by conflict and by the Boko Haram activities in that region. In addition, local community leaders became suspicious of the polio activities and the immunization activities. So what happened was that there was an enormous effort with the Nigerian government, with international agencies, to really partner with community leaders, traditional leaders, religious leaders, and with enormous success, that leadership in those regions really facilitated immunization.
But also this very grassroots effort of all these health workers who were sort of braved the markets and the taxi stands and that kind of thing to actually do it. I mean, there was a lot of sort of heroic grassroots support among people who were not leaders, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, this entire global effort, not only in Nigeria, but in countries like Pakistan and India and Afghanistan, would have not achieved anything if it wasn't for grassroots volunteers, in some cases paid workers and others, who have been trained to give polio immunization. And they go into areas where other people wouldn't be able to get access to. They're able to talk to their own communities and explain what is happening and why it's happening, and to get the trust of those communities. I mean, this has been an extraordinary achievement in terms of public health globally. There's never been anything else like this. And it's something that we have to learn from.
That was Dr. Helen Rees, the chair of the World Health Organization's International Health Regulations Emergency Committee on Polio. She was speaking to reporter Adam Phillips. Egyptian police have been deployed on Cairo's main streets and ground and around government buildings to ward off public protests against the government's failure to conduct an investigation of the 2013 Rabaa Mosque massacre. Today marks the second anniversary of the day when police killed more than 800 Muslim Brotherhood supporters at a sit-in at the Rabaa al-Adawiya Mosque in eastern Cairo. Human Rights Watch today called on the UN Human Rights Council to form an international commission of inquiry into what the rights organization calls the brutal clearing of the protesters at the mosque. HRW says as many as 1,000 protesters may have died that day. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan President Salva Kiir will not travel to Addis Ababa for peace talks with opposition leader Riek Machar. The French news agency says President Muhammadu Buhari has given the Nigerian military only 3 months to defeat the Islamist radical insurgency of Boko Haram. And a new book describes the African nation of Angola as an economic miracle for its rapid transformation after a brutal civil war. Coming up, music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, our final report on young Africans at the Mandela Washington Fellow. I'm Yehiyas Wuhim, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports. Sitting in for Sunny is Jonah Haskell. Hello, Jonah.
Hey, Yehiyas.
What's happening in the sports world this evening?
Well, we begin today in the Midwestern U.S. city of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where the 2015 PGA Championship's first round took place on Thursday. American Dustin Johnson is the leader after day one, having posted a score of 66, good enough for 6-under and sole possession of first. Johnson has now been at the top of the leaderboard following the first round of all four majors this year. In the previous three, Johnson was unable to hang on to his early lead, but he spoke about how his good play on Thursday has raised his confidence.
You know, I knew it was going to be fairly tough out there today. But, you know, got off to a great start, birdie in the first two holes, and then, you know, just hit it really solid all day. Drove it well, hit my irons really well, and then, you know, rolled the putter pretty nicely too. So, you know, it was just all around, it was just a really solid day.
Finishing one stroke behind Johnson at 5-under was David Lingmerth of Sweden. Lingmerth has never won a major before, but he did earn his first PGA Tour victory at the Memorial Tournament in June, where he defeated Justin Rose in a playoff. After his stellar round on Thursday, David said that his win at the Memorial was important to his recent success.
That win at Memorial kind of, you know, got me the confidence, I guess, and got me kick-started, and I put myself in the position to have some good chances to win some more tournaments after that, and it's really good practice for tournaments like these. So, I'm hoping I can keep it up and be there on Sunday.
Lingmerth was part of one of the early groups to tee off on Friday morning, although he is currently still at 5-under. Behind Lingmerth, eight players are tied for third at 4-under, including Australian Jason Day and American Matt Kuchar, while Thomas Bjorn of Denmark, who led for much of yesterday, and Briton Justin Rose are at 2-under. Also at 2-under currently is the only Zimbabwean on the PGA Tour, Brendan DeYoung. He finished at even on Thursday, but is off to a hot start with his early tee time on Friday. George Coty is another player taking advantage of an early start on Friday to move up the leaderboard to 2-under. World number 2 Jordan Spieth finished on Thursday with a strong 71 to put him at 1-under and within striking distance of the lead. Spieth also got an early start and is currently at 4-under after starting the second round very strong. The top player in the world, Rory McIlroy, returned yesterday for his first round of competitive golf since injuring his ankle in July and missing the British Open. He played well considering the strong winds, keeping pace with his groupmate Spieth to finish at the first round at 1-under. On Thursday evening, McIlroy said that he had some nerves on the first tee, but was overall happy with how he played.
It was a solid round of golf, happy with the way I struck the ball. I must say I was pretty nervous on the first tee. You know, it was just getting back there. It was nice to get that opening tee shot out of the way, and wasn't the best of starts, but to hit those two shots on the second hole and make birdie, that sort of settled me down and I could get into the round. But I think anything under par this afternoon was a decent score. I was, you know, I set myself a target going into the back nine. I knew there'd be a few chances, so I thought trying to shoot something under 70 was realistic. I sort of had a chance to do that after birdie in the 16th. You know, missed a good chance there on 17, and you know, unfortunate bogey the last, I guess. Just hit a 3-iron and held it up a little bit too much into the wind and leaked it right. But as I said, anything under par today is a good, you know, this afternoon anyway, is a good score.
Other golfers did not fare as well as McIlroy. Tiger Woods began the day decently, hovering around even for a while, but couldn't finish strong as he shot a 75 to finish way back at 3-over. South Africans Louis Oosthuizen and Brandon Grace are even and 1-under respectively, while Ricky Fowler and Vijay Singh are both 1-over. Phil Mickelson, who won the PGA Championship in 2005, did not have a great day, finishing at 2 over. The second round continues throughout Friday, and the final two rounds will be played this weekend, with the winner being named on Sunday.
Speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. I am the greatest.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now with sports news from all over the continent. And I believe he's beginning today with handball.
Tunisia prevailed over Argentina 35-29 to register their first victory in four matches at the Men's Youth Handball World Championships in Yekaterinburg, Russia, on Thursday. Today, Friday, Tunisia play Japan and Egypt face Germany in matches the Africans need to win to advance to the knockout stage of the contest. Algeria, who have lost all their matches and therefore have no prospects of progressing beyond the preliminary round, play Croatia in their final group fixture. Turning to netball, Jamaica dismissed Uganda 59-47 at the Netball World Cup in Sydney, Australia on Thursday. Today, Friday, Malawi encounter Jamaica, Zambia play Singapore, South Africa face England, and Uganda challenge world champions New Zealand. Meanwhile, the week-long Brookside Federation of East Africa Secondary School Sports Association Games starts in Huye, some 130 kilometers south of the Rwanda capital Kigali, tomorrow Saturday. Over 600 boys and girls from Burundi, Kenya, South Sudan, Tanzania, defending champions Uganda, and hosts Rwanda are vying for glory in athletics, badminton, basketball, football, handball, hockey, lawn tennis, netball, rugby, swimming, table tennis, and volleyball. In football, hosts Tunisia play Morocco in an Orange African Nations Championship qualifier in Tunis today, Friday. Elsewhere, Morocco welcome Ghana in a beach football friendly in El Jadida tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Morocco play Hungary at the same venue. Finally, in boxing, the Africa Confederation Boxing Championship starts in Casablanca, Morocco on Sunday. It's a qualifier for the AIBA World Championships in Doha, Qatar in October, where boxers are vying to qualify for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics.
Thank you very much. That's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. We move now to Montreal, where the Rogers Cup or Canadian Open is underway, having finished the third round on Thursday. There were not any upsets this time around, as all seeded players still in the tournament advance. World number one Novak Djokovic made short work of American Jack Sock, who won only three games en route to a straight sets victory for the Joker. Novak has been nursing a slight elbow injury throughout the tournament, but he says that it has not affected his play and that some pain is just part of the job.
Well, I mean, you got to learn to play through the pain and to bear the pain and go, you know, just accept the fact that as a professional athlete you deal with these things, and hopefully every day is going to get better.
Djokovic now moves on to the quarterfinal, where he will face Ernests Gulbis of Latvia, who is unseeded. Gulbis took on another unseeded opponent on Thursday, knocking American Donald Young out with a 6-4, 6-4 win. World number 2 Andy Murray advanced after defeating Gilles Muller 6-3, 6-2, and he will be facing last year's winner Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the quarters. Tsonga won a tight match against Bernard Tomic to advance, needing a tiebreaker to win the first set and taking the second one 6-3. A marquee matchup in the quarterfinals between Rafael Nadal and Kei Nishikori is set after both won their round 3 matches. Nadal, the 7 seed, took out Mikhail Hughesny in straight sets 6-3, 6-3, while Nishikori, seeded 4th, beat 13th seed David Goffin 6-4, 6-4. After his win, Nishikori said that he is excited to face Nadal.
Yeah, it's going to be another big challenge for me, you know, to beat Rafa. You know, I had never beat him before, and I haven't played him long time, so it's going to be very excited, and hope I can play good tennis again tomorrow.
The 16th seed, John Isner, also advanced to the quarterfinals after defeating Nick Kyrgios 7-5, 6-3. Kyrgios was fined and apologized for derogatory comments that he made yesterday during his match with Stan Wawrinka after he had initially refused. Some analysts were calling for a suspension to be handed down, but the ATP decided on just a fine. Isner will be playing against Jeremy Chardy in the quarters. The Frenchman advanced after defeating Ivo Karlovic in the closest match of the day, 4-6, 7-6, 6-4. In Toronto, where the women's tournament is taking place, the seemingly invincible Serena Williams won again, this time making short work of 16 seed Andrea Petkovic, who went down without much of a fight, 6-3, 6-3. Williams' opponent in the quarterfinals will be the unranked Roberta Vinci of Italy, who defeated Garia Gavrilova of Russia 6-4, 6-3. In another battle of unranked players, Belinda Bencic defeated Sabine Lisicki in a match that featured multiple large swings and momentum. The final score was 6-1, 1-6, 7-6. Number 2 seed Simona Halep continued her good play, dispatching 13 seed Angelique Kerber 6-3, 5-7, 6-4, and advanced to the quarterfinals to face another high seed, number 6 Agnieszka Radwanska. Radwanska needed 3 sets to win her match against Alize Cornet, but eventually triumphed 6-2, 4-6, 6-4 to move on. 5th seed Anna Ivanovic breezed through her match with Polona Hercog, 6-2, 6-3, and Lesya Surenko defeated Karina Witthoft, 6-3, 6-4. Surenko will face Sara Errani, who beat Victoria Azarenka in the quarters. The quarterfinals will take place later on Friday, with the semis taking place on Saturday, and the final will be played on Sunday. And that does it for today's edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell on my last day. Sonny Young will be back next week. Thanks so much for listening. Back to Yehaeus Wuhib.
Thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, our final report on young Africans at the Mandela Washington Fellow. And next, human trafficking continues to be a huge problem worldwide. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's Yovan Chaka Chaka with Makoti. South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Makoti. In its second year, President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative welcomed dozens of young Africans as Mandela Washington Fellows. They came to the U.S. for 6 weeks of study at U.S. universities and a summit meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. In our final report on the Fellows, Ghanaian business magazine publisher Felix Kolotse deepened his understanding of the intersection of making money and serving the community.
Every day I get fresh ideas. Those times I thought entrepreneurship is where we have arrived, but I realized that there are more things that I can do than what I'm doing.
If they were able to try so hard...
General Mosquito Bosco!
...written by great men like Dr. Kofi Annan. My name is Felix Delacluche from Ghana. I'm the publisher of a business newspaper called Business Day. And what we do is to provide in-depth reports, business reports on Ghana's economy and finance. Not only Ghana, but we cover West Africa and then also international trade. About 30 employees that have direct employment, and then we provide 200 indirect employment for news vendors.
Y'all, it's so great to have you guys back again this year. I know it's a different group.
I have gone through a number of, companies, and I have seen some best practices there, which if I get back to Ghana, I could be able to apply the same thing and still continue to be in business.
My name is Felix from Ghana. Let me commend you. You guys are doing a great job in my country. And my question on a more serious note, you guys are making money. What has been your contribution to society? What is your area of corporate social responsibility?
I'm also a leader of a youth, an association in Accra. That's over 400 people where I mentor and then give them training for positive direction. And what we also do as a publisher of Business Day, I've set aside 3% of our income, which is directed to support this organization and also charity, where we take our street children and make sure that they get back to school. I became an orphan at the age of 7, and that moved me out to be able to do so many things in life, because I believe strong, my passion is to provide jobs for the youth, because I believe that as a country, the rate at which unemployment is going on, the country is a threat to national security. And if something concrete is not done about it, we'll be at risk, because we have a lot of frustrated graduates in the system who finish universities, and these are good, graduates, but are not getting a job.
And one thing I've learned in U.S. years, if there's trouble or there's a problem, they don't complain, but they solve it. They provide solutions.
Even here, I've decided to come out with a group of fellows, and we are meeting every evening to try as much as possible. We have a list of ideas. We keep on drawing, dropping, dropping. They want to focus on one single thing that could transform our various countries and Africa as a whole.
That was Felix Kolotse, a Mandela Fellow from Ghana. Human trafficking continues to be a huge problem worldwide, but many people are working to stop it. A Ugandan woman in South Sudan has been recognized by the U.S. State Department for her efforts to stop sexual exploitation in the capital, Juba. Catherine Krunendike Nabukwasi is among the 8 people Secretary of State John Kerry named as heroes recently in Washington. In South Sudan, she founded a shelter for hundreds of street kids vulnerable to prostitution. Nabukwasi tells reporter Ayan Bior she did not expect the award.
I felt so, so, so overwhelmed with emotion, and giving me more energy and more passion for these children, and to know that what I was doing was right, and to know that there were so many other people around the world who thought that is the right thing to do. I felt very, very, very much honored. And also I reflected on all those people who had helped me to make it a success.
could you tell me your story of a young Ugandan girl who travels to South Sudan and decides to invest her life and passion to work for the forgotten children of South Sudan?
Although I'm not South Sudanese, I considered myself as an African, and South Sudan has always been at my heart because I worked there. I read all the stories of slavery, of even the girl in Darfur. I got so angry about things that were happening. I worked there, and I saw the destitution and the desperation of children, the suffering, the dying, people just dying like flies. There was nothing to protect you when you were there. So I really wanted to go to South Sudan, and I really hoped that everybody feels the way I feel about it. So that's why I went to work.
What keeps you passionate and motivated to continue your work despite the immense challenges that Confident Children Out of Conflict faces?
This organization helps me discover the plight of children who represented a lot of South Sudanese, because there hasn't been protection for a very long time for people who had lived for many years in IDP camps, how the situation had broken down. And I thought I would work with these children because I discovered that there were so many children who were sexually abused, who were engaging in prostitution. And somehow there was no organization at the time trying to do something about it. And at that point, at some point, there was a child who was gang raped. And for me, it was too much. And I decided that I had to do this, and I had to do it whether I had money or not. And I didn't have any money, but I started to do it with a few girls. And then eventually girls brought others. I worked also with boys and tried my best to help them, because I realized that I was protected, I was educated. They had no education. They were there suffering. And if I am just looking for a job, or because I'm not employed, it's the problem. What about them who are not even educated, who don't have anything? If I don't survive, then I don't expect them to survive. So I decided that I will work with them, a few of them at a time. Unfortunately, they started telling each other, and then they became many.
What's it like for you to watch that transformation in these children who live a life of fear and anxiety into a life where children live or should live as children? What's it like for you to see that transformation?
When you ask that question, I get goosebumps. You should see me. It is the most rewarding thing that I can ever get. It's better than anything for me to see that these children, who are nothing, and they are becoming everything. We have some of the brightest girls in our program. One of the girls is now in school in Uganda, and she's getting distinctions. Imagine getting 12 distinctions. She wants to be a doctor, and she will be. And we have some of the brightest children in the program. And so for me, it shows that there are children out there who should be part, and they are being left out because of the situation.
That's Catherine Cronin-Dyke-Nabukwasi speaking to VOA's Ian Bior in Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on leading figures with the groups conducting terrorist attacks in the Sahel and other areas of North Africa. Mokhtar Belmokhtar is the founder and leader of the Khalid Abu El Abbas Brigade, also known as the Signed in Blood Battalion. Under his command in January of this year, it conducted a deadly attack on a gas facility in Al Aminas, Algeria. At least 37 hostages, including four Americans, were killed in the attack. Previously, he served in the Algerian army and later was a senior commander in Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, taking part in numerous terrorist attacks and kidnappings of Westerners. In June 2004, a tribunal in Algeria sentenced him in absentia to death for forming terrorist groups, robbery, and the use of illegal weapons. He has also been sanctioned by the U.S. Department of Treasury and the United Nations. Belmokhtar was born June 1, 1972, in Jardiya, Algeria. He has black hair and is blind in one eye. He has used the aliases Abu Al-Abbas and Mr. Marlboro. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to Belmokhtar's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.